The following podcast is part of the MindBodySpirit.fm podcast network.
Support for this show comes from the Spirituality and Health Annual Holiday Gift Guide, a special section in the November-December 2016 issue featuring inspiring and unique products. Reach our conscious community and reserve your advertising space today. Email Tabitha at spiritualityhealth.com or call 231-933-5660, extension 305.
From Spirituality and Health magazine, I'm Rabbi Rami, and this is Essential Conversations. My guest today is Hugh Byrne. He's author of The Here and Now Habit, How Mindfulness Can Help You Break Unhealthy Habits Once and for All. An interview with Hugh appears in the July-August issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Hugh Byrne, welcome to Essential Conversations.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be with you, Rabbi.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk with you. This is something that I'm very interested in, mindfulness, not habits. So, but if you can help me break mine, that would be great, as long as I don't break the habit of practicing mindfulness. That will not be helpful.
That's right.
So let's begin with your own story, actually. How did you come to mindfulness practice?
You know, I grew up in the Christian tradition, but I was never, it kind of never really got hold of me deeply. I was from a Catholic Irish family, a large family. And, you know, I tried when I was a kid to connect with God, but it kind of never quite happened. And in my late teens and 20s, I became quite political and quite active and quite atheist, really, you could say. And it wasn't till I was in my 30s, I was doing a lot of activist work and human rights work, that I read a book actually by Alan Watts called The Way of Zen. And it was kind of, I didn't know a lot about it, but it seemed very interesting to me. And I found the more I read it, the more my mind was kind of becoming more open and seeing things in a different way. And I had one of those experiences where a kind of a letting go experience or a mind expanding experience that was kind of outside of the everyday realm of my you know, everyday life. And it was enough to encourage me to explore more the teachings, the kind of the teachings, the wisdom teachings, mainly from the East. And I began reading more, and I began practicing meditation. And it was over a period of a number of years. And it was the next kind of big thing for me was doing a meditation retreat where I had about 9 or 10 days to just get kind of settle into silence. And I recognized how much I enjoyed that, how much it kind of touched into something very, very basic and very meaningful in me. And that's really got me on the road. That was maybe 25 plus years ago. And from then on, it's been more, not that it's been plain sailing, but it's been, I've never really doubted that this was a path that I wanted to be on.
Well, I'm glad you referenced Alan Watts. I mean, I love Alan Watts. And B, I think that the people like him from that generation, they're sort of lost in the current search. People don't usually quote Alan Watts or even Krishnamurti or any of these people that were so important to you and to me as well. So I'm glad it was Alan Watts who turned you on to this. So do you practice within a specific lineage? Was there a specific teacher that you followed?
Yeah, I did. I began really in the Zen tradition, but I didn't really have a teacher in that tradition. I just practiced with a group, and I found it very, very helpful. This was for a number of maybe 3 or 4 years. But the longer meditation retreat I did, and then the subsequent retreats after that, were in the insight meditation, sometimes called Vipassana, which really just means seeing clearly. The tradition that comes out of Southern Asia, you know, where the Buddha's teachings came, first of all, went south into what is today Sri Lanka, and then, you know, what's today Thailand and Burma and Cambodia, and then other teachings later went north along the Silk Road, ultimately to China and Japan. So where the teachings that I practice in, the tradition I practice in, comes out of the Theravadan tradition of South Asia. And the teachers, I didn't practice a lot with Asian teachers. It was more kind of the generation. There was an intermediate generation of Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein up in Barre, Massachusetts, at the Insight Meditation Society, Sharon Salzberg, folks that went in the 60s and 70s and studied with Asian teachers and then came back to the West in the 70s and started retreat centers, including the two major centers, Insight Meditation in Barre, Massachusetts, and Spirit Rock out in California. And I would say my main teachers have been Christopher Titmus, who's an English teacher, very much an activist, Jack Kornfield, Tara Brach, who's a colleague of mine here in Washington. Those have been some of my major influences, really. The Western teachers, who most of whom practiced in Asia and really came back and made the teachings very, very accessible to Western audiences. I think that's the great gift of people like Jack Kornfield, Sharon Salzberg, Joseph Goldstein. Folks actually, you know, interestingly enough, many of whom of their background is Jewish, you know, and often kind of jokingly called Jew-boos or Boo-Jews, had very, very significant role in kind of bringing the teachings into the West, wrote many, many books, and, you know, very, very respected teachers here today, you know.
Also sort of shaping it in, or I don't know if shaping is the right word, maybe filtering it through Western psychology. A lot
absolutely,
of this.
Yeah.
And your book, too, has that a psychological bent to it, I think, self-help kind of, and I don't know if that's the term you want to use, but helping people in this case break unhealthy habits, to quote the title itself. Do you consider yourself a Buddhist?
I do. I'm very much, I don't see it, as an ism so much. I don't see it, so much in a devotional sense, as more a very pragmatic way of freeing ourselves from suffering. I see it as very pragmatic, very experiential. And some people are more into the devotional side of it, but I don't find myself pulled so much in that direction. I'm more pulled in the direction of how do we live more freely? How do we find more peace and ease in our lives? And so I do teach, I teach Buddhist meditation. I teach, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path and the foundations of mindfulness. But I also teach secular mindfulness, and I don't find it a contradiction at all. So I teach mindfulness-based stress reduction, the program that Jon Kabat-Zinn developed, which is very secular. It doesn't talk very much about Buddhism, except to just reference that it came out of that tradition. But it teaches it the practice of mindfulness in a more secular way. So I find myself actually quite comfortable in both of those worlds. And as you say, very much, very influenced by Western psychology, by the findings of neuroscience. And I use those a lot in the book, of what's going on in our brains, and how habits, take over, if you like, a part of our brain, certain brain processes and all of that. And what I find really interesting is the ways in which these neuroscience, in many ways, kind of confirms some of the ancient wisdom teachings from Buddhism and other traditions.
So let's talk a second about how habits sort of capture the mind and I guess the will. How do you understand that? I mean, you can define habits for us and then tell us how they work.
Yeah, I mean, anything that gets repeated often enough under consistent conditions. I mean, normally it need to be, you know, sometimes something you do, like you get in the car and after, you know, the 50th time or however many times it might be, you put your seatbelt on. At first, it's a very intentional action, you know, but after a while, the brain, you know, if you kind of personify the brain, kind of give it as kind of a person, a quality of a person, the brain kind of says, oh, every time I get in, you know, the person gets in the car, this happens. So I don't need to think that through every time. It can just become a natural thing after a certain amount of times. And that may vary from person to person and habit to habit. But after a while, it becomes habitual. And then you no longer need to think about it. It goes into the faster moving brain process. The great writer, psychologist, Daniel Kahneman, I don't know if you've read his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, about kind of the way the brain works and the way our brains can get us into trouble. He talks about it as, he calls it System 1, that kind of fast-acting, more instinctual brain process, and System 2 being the more slower, more intentional, more rational, more thought-through process. And so what happens when something becomes habitual, even if we have the intention to change that habit, it's quite difficult to do, as we all know probably from New Year's resolutions, that when the slower acting brain processes come up against these fast-acting, more instinctual processes, the instinctual ones tend to win out. And that's why habits can be so sticky, so tenacious, so hard to change. And so that's where the kind of the mindfulness comes in. And the insight, I think, of my book, I'm not the only one who said this, but I think, you know, I'm saying it in a kind of a large way of kind of linking habit change to the practice of mindfulness, that this really is a key. And I'm happy to kind of talk about that.
Want to talk about that. I want to use what you just said a moment ago. Do you think mindfulness in effect shifts us from System 1 to System 2, fast thinking to slow thinking, so we get a handle on what? Yeah. Is that how it works? So you want to go into that more?
That is exactly how I understand it working. That if we can bring processes that have become automatic and unconscious. So if you think of it as the radar screen, it's operating underneath the radar or off the radar. And we're bringing it back in onto the radar so we can see that blip. We can see that, you know, if it's a habit of like late in the evening, going to the freezer for ice cream, and after a while that becomes, you know, maybe it's triggered by feeling anxious or lonely or feeling like we deserve a treat at the end of the day. After a while, it becomes automatic. And in order to change that habit, it's really important to bring it into awareness, to know, okay, this is when it tends to happen. These are the conditions it happens under. The more we can do that, then we're bringing it onto the radar screen, as it were. And then we can see, okay, when I feel that urge, that, you know, that tightness in my stomach that sends the message to the brain, oh, I need some ice cream now, I want some ice cream now, then instead of going straight to the freezer, you can actually say, okay, there is an alternative. I could actually stay with this feeling rather than choosing to go to the freezer and getting ice cream.
Okay,
and
now I know
that
why.
Might mean, yeah.
Now I know why it doesn't work for me. If my choice is ice cream or sitting and breathing, no, I'm going
exactly,
for the ice cream.
Exactly. So it's often, I'm not saying it's going to be easy to change. I'm not saying it's just like seeing it automatically you change, because quite often we have to be with an experience that is not so easy. But then at least we can make a choice. We can say, now, if over a period of 6 months I'm putting on 10 or 12 pound by doing this in this unconscious way, is it worth it to me to put up with some discomfort? You could say the same thing about smoking, you know, of how, you know, we all know how harmful that is. You're going to have to put up with some discomfort, some feeling of kind of cold turkey, of like, oh, I've got to feel this, like, got to have it. But I can actually if I'm aware of it, I can stay with those feelings rather than acting out the habit. And over time, I can change unhealthy habits. And so mindfulness in that way is the key. It brings what's unconscious into consciousness. It makes what's invisible visible. And then we're in a place where we can make a change.
So is there an assumption in what you're talking about? I mean, two things come to mind. One is, who is the you that's making the shift? You know, like if you're talking about mindfulness and you say, I'm training the mind. Yeah. What's the I that's doing that? And how does that play into the notion of free will? And you've got 2 minutes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think what we're connecting with in those situations is kind of our deepest intentions. I mean, a deeper sense of who we are, which is may well be different from the I that is kind of going in the instinctual direction, going in the direction of feeling, okay, I need this now. I've got to have it now. Mm-hmm. That you know, I mean, it's the same person that is feeling that, but we're pulling ourselves out of that kind of the I that's connecting with, that's craving something, that's in a kind of tunnel vision, isn't able to connect with the larger picture of what's what is best for me, you know, for this person, this being. And the more I can bring it back to, what do I really want? What do I most deeply care about? Is it more ice cream? Is it to smoke that cigarette? Is it to take this drug? Or is it to live in a healthy way? Is it to be more free of craving and compulsion and more in a position to choose? So it's that sense of that deeper sense of who we are, what we care about, what we most value, that I think that mindfulness is connecting us with.
So in Judaism, the terms we use that speak to this, the Hebrew is mochin de katnut and mochin de gadlut. Mochin de katnut means narrow mind, and mochin de gadlut means spacious mind. And when you're in narrow mind, that's where the habits, I mean, that's why you're in narrow mind. It's sort of driven by those habits. And then through one meditation system or another, you can shift into spacious mind and then observe the desire to smoke or the desire to eat the ice cream and not be motivated to actually, or at least have the freedom to choose not to do it.
I think that's a wonderful way of seeing it, because I think it really gels with the science. The science, the neuroscience really points to the way in which when we're caught up in a very, a kind of a fight or flight based response, we go into a kind of tunnel vision. You know, we're just focused. Like you think the obvious example would be an addict craving the drug. You know, the addict at that stage, if it's really a very strongly developed addiction, is not able to look back and see, oh, is this really good for my life? Is it helpful to me? There's a knowing probably that it isn't helpful, but that narrow, gotta have this, I'll die without it, is so strong at that moment. So how do we move out of that narrow kind of tunnel vision into that more spacious mind? And I think mindfulness is really a wonderful practice for doing that. Maybe it's not the only practice. We could maybe do, you know, pray, or do, you know, kind of, if we could take a walk in the woods, but some way in which we connect with a larger sense of ourselves, what you termed the spacious mind. And I think that's what mindfulness helps us to do.
And you can learn how to do it, really, by reading Hugh's book, The Here and Now Habit. So I'm going to have to leave it there, though I have a million more questions and would love to talk with you longer. We don't have any longer. My guest today was Hugh Byrne. He's author of The Here and Now Habit, How Mindfulness Can Help You Break Unhealthy Habits Once and for All. An interview with Hugh appears in the July-August issue of Spirituality and Health magazine. Hugh Byrne, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Conversations.
It was a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking with us. Support for this show comes from Spirituality and Health's annual holiday gift guide, a special section in the November-December 2016 issue, and on the website, featuring inspiring and unique products. Reach our conscious community and reserve your advertising space today. You can email Tabitha at spiritualityhealth.com, or you can call her at 231-933-5660, extension 305. Essential Conversations with Rabbi Rami is a project of Spirituality and Health magazine. Visit spiritualityhealth.com and subscribe to the magazine in either print or digital formats, and download the iTunes app for this podcast. Essential Conversations is produced by Ezra Baker, and our program coordinator is Alma Tassi. I'm Rabbi Rami. Thanks for listening.